It's the Lou Desmond and Company Show.
So you heard the usual disclaimer that you hear at the beginning of every show. So we're going to add some more disclaimer tonight. The Lou Desmond Company Show isn't the Lou Desmond and Company Show as you usually get on Monday, because the company is missing except for me, and the host is missing, Lou. So instead, we're going to do something a little bit different tonight. I am John Tulak, International Man of Mystery, as Lou likes to introduce me. I am an international business attorney, and I have for our guest this evening a colleague of mine from the business world, someone I've known and liked and trusted and worked with for the last 10 years, and that's Lisa Anderson of LMA Consulting Group. Good evening, Lisa.
Glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about what a supply chain management consultant does, because that's what you do and you do it so well.
Well, you know, the good news is that a lot of people know more about what supply chain management is these days than there used to be prior to the pandemic. So in essence, the bottom line is work with manufacturers and distributors to get the right products in the right place at the right time in a way that's profitable and with more cash available. So that just means really that consumers and businesses have what they need where they need it, in an efficient manner.
Okay. So in other words, if we want something, we're really depending on a whole lot of people in the middle to make sure that that something gets on the shelf or gets into an Amazon warehouse somewhere so that we can actually get what we want when we want it or need it, right?
Absolutely. There are typically speaking many suppliers, and then you have manufacturers, many times multiple manufacturers. And then you could go through a couple of different channels too before you get to the end customer, depending upon what your product is. So there's a lot of pieces to the supply chain to keep it all working.
So if you're a consumer, the what's in it for me proposition is without people like you and the others who make sure that all the systems work properly, we wouldn't get what we want. And I guess the what's in it for me proposition for a business person is even if they don't think they have a supply chain, they're quite dependent on a lot of other vendors and even their own customers that are dependent on supply chain management, without which their business wouldn't function.
Yeah, I mean, it has definitely highlighted the importance during the pandemic. We had all sorts of shortages and extended lead times throughout, you know, depending upon, like you said, if you're a consumer or a business owner, both experienced both of those issues, in addition to inflation, which also is partly related to a supply chain challenge.
So I guess for the most part, the supply has caught up with demand in a whole lot of areas, and we're still hearing about shortages in certain critical kinds of things, like certain kinds of chips and minerals for battery production and so on. But are things more or less, at least from the standpoint of consumer goods, back in balance?
Yeah, like you said, largely, 70-30, I guess you could say, instead of the 80-20 rule. But 70-30, they are back in alignment, meaning that like the ports don't have, miles and miles of container ships waiting to be offloaded, as an example. We averted a rail strike. We do have a lot of really full warehouses, and there is still some supply chain challenges there. But generally speaking, a lot of the ones talked about in the news are largely gone, but they do exist in some critical areas, like you said, like chips as an example.
Right. So let's talk about the full warehouses for a moment. I heard that the description for that is called the bullwhip effect, that, you know, if you're a customer and you need, especially during the lockdown, you needed one widget, but your distributor wouldn't sell you one widget. So you ordered the 10 and you only needed the one. And so 9 are sitting in your inventory somewhere. And then that wholesaler, you know, is got to go and replace what's on the shelf and wants to order 10. But the supplier says, no, your minimum purchase is 100. So there's 90 sitting in the shelf. Is that why the warehouses are full today? Is that the catch up of all those ships that finally made port, got unloaded, are sitting there, and the demand in that respect still is not caught up with now what is oversupply in a lot of areas?
Well, you're right. I mean, it is still a supply chain disruption, if you will, as to why we have so much inventory. And the bullwhip effect is the major reason for it, which is as pretty much as you described. I mean, like you said, all of the container ships showed up at once, in essence, is the problem. And then, things are so far behind. So we overorder in the beginning because we think, gosh, I can't get anything, so I may as well like get extra. And then once you finally start receiving the product, you find out, oh no, now I want to shut it off, but now everything and more continues to arrive. So now we do have an inventory glut. However, in some cases, we also are planning to have extra inventory because we know that we have too much risk in our supply chain.
Right. So resiliency is one of the ways of eliminating the risk in the supply chain, and having a supply of something that is especially critical to a manufacturer in particular. Having sufficient inventory on hand kind of goes against the last 20 or 30 years of just in time and lean and all the other things that says, really run an efficient, tight operation. But then as soon as something goes wrong, you're out of stuff. So are we moving back towards some new kind of balance in terms of super efficiency versus guarding against risk with resiliency?
Well, I mean, you're right. Manufacturers and distributors have gone to more of a just-in-case kind of a thinking because they really were afraid of running out like they were during the pandemic. But we're really evolving. I'm seeing a lot of clients looking at right-sizing their inventory. They don't want to carry a lot of excess inventory because it's cash tied up unnecessarily, and with rising interest rates, that's an issue. So they're definitely looking to be smart about it. But overall, I think that I'm just thinking about it, but across the board, at least the smart manufacturers are carrying inventory of strategic items or items that they have single sourced, because it's more than just risk of, there's a lot of risks out there between weather, wars, just normal disruptions, strikes, all sorts of problems. So if they don't have enough sources, they're ordering extra, if you will. And if they have special risk, they're ordering extra. So they are ordering more, but they also are trying to reduce inventory in the rest of their items.
So if you're thinking about a recession coming up this year, or maybe toward the end of the year, or the next year, and you're looking at all those goods, would we expect to see that excess inventory get liquidated as a way of getting to cash and helping to get through the bad times?
Well, I mean, yes, I think it's going to depend on which products and, who's in those markets, because I think the smart companies are building resilience into their supply chains. They are, doing it the right way. They're reducing inventory in the items where they really don't need to carry excess inventory, and they're building up inventory and or capabilities in the items that are either strategic or, important for the number one customer or whatever. So it depends, but on those are the smart companies. But if you call the average and certainly the weak companies, for sure, they're going to end up with a mountain of inventory because, of course, demand's going to fall off when the recession does take hold. And then they're going to be, the opposite of the bullwhip effect is going to be going on. So they're going to end up stuck with all sorts of inventory, thinking about selling it off at a discount, but that could create other issues. So that's why I see more opportunities in the future for the companies that are proactive.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Of course, out of every crisis comes opportunity, and the well-prepared company will be perfectly situated to take advantage of some of that. And of course, in tough times, cash is king. So, turning inventory that you can't sell into cash, you can do that the hard way and liquidate it, or you can do it with some strategic purpose ahead of time and do a little bit better. Now, I got to turn to something that you mentioned that I can't resist. You talked about weather risk. Well, for weather risk, they have, weather derivatives and futures contracts and insurance, all kinds of way of dealing with weather. But how about weather balloon risk, particularly when
I know, right? From China? That is it's becoming a bigger and bigger risk, to be sure.
So I'm wondering, what's going on in the skies, and maybe that's why the bird population is so far down. It's getting so crowded with other stuff that the birds don't like. I mean, four unidentified flying objects, as we used to refer to them, and as most people still do, were shot down over the last 8 days after, our military finally acknowledges a weather balloon or supposed weather balloon and lets it go across the entire continent. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that if you're a consumer, you're thinking about it very differently than if you're a manufacturer or distributor. If you're a manufacturer or distributor and you're reliant on China, which obviously a lot of our manufacturers are, because even if they're not purchasing products directly, somewhere in their supply chains, their suppliers, somebody is going to be purchasing something from China. And all it really means, as you well know, because even with the zero COVID policies, it meant that like disruptions could come and we had no control over them. So now with balloons threatening us in some way or another, all that means is that we have another threat. So if they want to ensure uninterrupted supply for their key customers, they have to be adding flexibility and resilience into their system somehow, like reshore, nearshore, do something.
And it's important to keep track of what our government does in response to incidents like this. So one of the things that the government is considering doing is sanctioning the Chinese companies that built these balloons or any of the payloads that were on any of these balloons that might be identified after being shot to pieces, or any contributor of raw materials or parts to the balloon. So if you just happen to be doing business with a company that made parts that go into a balloon that gets shot down off the coast of South Carolina, all of a sudden you've lost a supplier. I mean, keeping up with what goes on in the world, I think is essential for any business person to do, to run a company properly today, large or small, if you have anything that's coming in from outside the country.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you're definitely an international expert, so you could speak to this, but I definitely see more risk than I've seen in a long time. There's going to be more, like we talked about, out of risk comes opportunities. So I see also that companies that are, they're not wanting to like pivot and do the things that they have to be successful in this environment, which would be understandable in the sense that, it's not going to be for the faint of heart, but they are not going to do so well. And so there's going to be, even more supply chain changes coming as people switch suppliers, and then it takes, the bullwhip effect starts happening in a smaller, in a certain supply base. So lots of disruptions ahead.
I think that's true. There's always another reason or set of reasons why your supply chain, with all the great software and all the great expectations of having it all work just right, can get disrupted by especially political or geopolitical events. And we seem to have an elevated set of risks with the continued war with Ukraine and Russia and all the disruptions that causes, and the fact that a good chunk of the rest of the world hasn't signed on to the idea of sanctioning Russia, even though many countries, India included, as it continues to buy more and more Russian oil cargoes, says, we don't like what you're doing, but we're still going to buy your oil. Keeping up with the elevated threat levels in different countries. Like, again, we've had a level 4 travel advisory from the State Department. Americans should not who travel to Russia. And if you are in Russia, you should be getting out of there because you're at risk of being a pawn in a bigger battle, in a bigger
fight.
Same thing in China. I just think it's much higher than I consider to be acceptable risk these days to be a business person, particularly in certain areas where you go visit in China and next thing you know, just like the woman reporter from Australia, she gets detained and is held hostage until Australia changes its policies toward China.
Yeah, well, which means she won't get out of there anytime soon. So I would agree with you. I think there's a lot more risk going on currently. And if really I find that clients really have to keep track of it, or they have to find trusted advisors or experts or something so that they can be aware of what's important to their business so that they, if they want to thrive anyway, or at least survive, they'll have to.
Indeed. I used to tell my international business students that you have to keep up what's going on in the world. And whether I was teaching at law school level with a bunch of people just want to learn the law, or business people who are taking it because they want to get involved in international business, students in particular were terrible at knowing what was going on in the world. So at the beginning of every class, I would start with what's going on in the world and make them tell me. We were talking about the implications of what the news of the day was all about relative to whatever the topics would be for that evening. And it was my favorite time of the class. And it actually became a favorite time for the students once they got into the idea, oh, I guess we have to do this and keep up. It became an interesting discussion every night.
Yep.
So how do we encourage that? I know you're very involved with various trade associations associated with supply chain, and you have people who do keep up and you talk to each other about it. How would a typical business person keep up?
Well, that's what I'm finding is that I belong to several groups. I did pare back during the pandemic. But I belong to several groups and I get something that's critical from each one. You know, I give as well, but I also want to stay up to date on what's going on in certain areas of the world, if to your point, or certain products or certain, professions. So it is, I think, being involved in trade organizations, could be alumni associations, also could be things like, I know you and I both like do newsletters and podcasts and are, you know, we're on radio. So there's plenty of ways to stay informed, but it's just spending the time and prioritizing which sources and what to do.
Yeah. Back, if you remember, export plan that Obama administration had to double exports in 5 years. There were 22 government agencies that were involved in that initiative. And there were a lot of good features to it, but it was also enormous in terms of just the amount of government involvement in the different parts of what was going to make this a successful initiative. And the double export website that went up that was supposed to be a mega portal collecting all this stuff was weeks and months behind what each individual agency was actually doing. And I found that my interns could call the stuff from the other website and put it out in a newsletter and on our website faster than the government was getting it up on its website. And I still worry about that just the
I think you're right. I mean, that's a problem.
Yeah, that is out there. If you really have trouble sleeping, you pick up a copy of the Federal Register and start reading a proposed regulation and you go right out. Just the thousands of pages that are put out monthly, nobody can keep up with that. So the ability to find companies that can aggregate it either in a newsletter service free or pay is I think essential reading for any business person. But I have a hard time getting my own clients who've worked with me for years sometimes to keep up. And it's like, well, you'll tell us anything that's important. Oh, okay.
Well, I have some of the same. It's true. It's quite impossible to keep up everything with everything these days. So I think you're absolutely right. You really should think about what's, I mean, each business has a different set of information that's important to their business. Like I used to be a vice president of operations for an adult incontinence manufacturer. And so we're really reliant on pulp and paper prices as well as plastic and nonwovens and those kind of things. So, it doesn't mean I need to read about, I don't know, something steel, but I needed to read about, or at least be aware of what's happening in those particular industries. So you can at least prioritize.
Exactly. So, with the amount of time that we have left, I want to shift to another topic. And that's something that has gotten a lot more traction in the last year or so. And that's the idea of reshoring as an alternative to managing long supply chains, especially coming from China or other parts of Asia. And I guess the choices really are, to either build resilience by diversifying to more than one country, so you're not overly reliant on one particular place in the world or one particular country that's troublesome for a lot of reasons, like China is, or you could nearshore to a place like Mexico, or even for certain things, Canada, because we have the USMCA that gives them favorable ability to bring those goods into the United States or actually bring production back home. And I don't know what you're seeing, but I'm certainly seeing a lot more interest in reshoring. And we've had government policy in the last year that has just emphasized, to the exclusion of anything else, buy American. If you're going to do business with the government, then it's, sell American products to the government. What are you seeing in that
No,
respect?
I'm definitely seeing clients, and I'm hearing about in the news. Like, for example, I was just called recently for a quote about a sports manufacturer that was reshoring, and so therefore they had to invest more money, and so their financials didn't look as good. And I said, well, I mean, that's the right thing to do, long term. So it's coming up in the news, but it's also all the CEO surveys show that. Executives are doing more than thinking about it. They're starting to act on it. But the problem is it's not like something you snap your fingers and suddenly you're reshored. And there's a lot of ways to do it, right? You could start your own facility, you could expand operations, you could partner with other people. And most likely, you're not going to advertise it because then you're going to lose your source of supply while you're reshoring. So it makes it complicated. But for sure, clients are definitely reshoring, and I have a couple of examples of clients that are getting the benefits of folks reshoring that are in the news. So, like a chip manufacturer in Arizona, I had a HVAC manufacturer, building products manufacturer that relates to that was bidding on a project, and they were looking good to win it. I have another one that's looking at is bidding on a project with relation to Tesla because they're expanding their capabilities. So there's a lot that I do see happening where, through the supply chain, we're starting to see it come up.
And have you run across any of your clients or businesses that you know that are actually surveying their customers to see how much a customer might pay in the way of a premium if something was largely or 100% American made?
Well, I think that no, none of them are doing that, but I mean, that seems like it would be a good idea. I mean, I think that we're going to get to that point, especially with, we've already shot down four balloons so far. Who knows how many more? But basically, as consumers become more aware of what's going on, they're going to become, more likely to pay more money for something that's produced in the US where they can, count on it, and it provides jobs in this area. So I think right so far, no, but I see that as potential for the future.
It just strikes me, it's funny you're hearing this from a lawyer, not someone who makes anything, but it seems to me that there's a lot of talk about the desirability of buying American. And then when it gets down to, will you actually do that as a consumer, then you look at your pocketbook and you see how far you want to stretch that dollar, and you hesitate, or you go and you buy the cheaper of the two alternatives. It yeah. seems to me that until you get buy-in from the people who will actually buy your product, you can't really make good decisions about reassuring.